Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Shekman. In addition to the power of the stories that Who, What, Why brings you each and every day, we regularly bring you the power of the words and voices of people with a lot to say about the state of the world. In 2015, we shared with you over 50 podcasts, with subjects ranging from the little understood role of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld following the September 11th attacks, to new and sustainable methods of burial. As we wrap up this year, we wanted to give you an amuse-bouche of what we've been doing. We hope that you'll want to follow some of the links to dig deeper into the full meal. If you stay with us for the next 40 minutes, you'll spend some time with Dave Talbot examining some of the hidden history of Alan Dulles, the CIA, and its linkage to the JFK assassination. You'll meet Professor Michael Glennon and preview his look at how government really works. It's not what you think. Professor and author Peter Dale Scott ruminates on the mysterious concept of continuity of government. You'll learn about the life of a broken prisoner at Gitmo, about an artist who turned up dead after his work tried to expose the Bush family. Russ Baker explains his intellectual journey to understand what makes the Bushes truly a family of secrets. And one of our nation's most prominent atheists is downright evangelical in his desire to see religion die. So sit back, relax, and join the Who, What, Why conversation. One of those conversations was with journalist David Talbot. Talbot's new book, The Devil's Chessboard, looks at the CIA's most powerful director, Alan Dulles, and provides many new discoveries about Dulles. These include events during World War II and the Cold War, as well as secrets and crucial new information relating to the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Yes, I mean, this is what many scholars now today call the deep state. These are the people who, no matter who happens to be president, run America. They're powerful Wall Street lawyers, investment bankers, national security officials. They all belong to the same clubs. In the Dulles' case, the key club was the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. And this is where these men, and in those days, probably 99.9% were men, hammer out their ideas, the policy that later becomes the official policy of the United States. Again, no matter who happens to be president. This is the American ruling class.
And part of it is that it wasn't always in America's interest, but it was in the interest of Dulles and in the interests of the people that he essentially represented.
To them, American interests were the interests of the power elite. They felt that democracy was too important to be left in the hands of the people or its elected representatives. Alan Dulles said famously, while he was running for Congress, he took one stab at democracy as a younger man running for Congress from a wealthy district in New York. And he lost terribly, had no feel for the electoral game. He said democracy was best left in the hands of the intelligent people, as he put it, by which, of course, he meant people like him and his brother. In Alan Dulles' worldview, of course, the Nazi ideology was still part of the international capitalism. He was doing business with these men, as I say. The Nazis were using Swiss banks during the war when Dulles was in Switzerland to stash the loot that they were, in some cases, ripping literally from the teeth of Jews in concentration camps, and the loot that they were taking from countries they were invading. And he was looking the other way. He thought that it was important that Germany be strong after the war. He didn't care if the West German government, the democratic government, was included many high-ranking Nazis.
Why did the Kennedys keep Dulles around?
I think that advice probably came from his father, Joe Kennedy. Joe Kennedy was very concerned that this young president who had won by such a narrow margin should be seen as someone who was not going to rock the boat too much. And so he thought it was important to incorporate some of the elements of the old regime within this new presidency. And so young Kennedy, JFK, does indeed do that. He picks not only Dulles, he keeps Dulles in office at the CIA, he keeps J. Edgar Hoover in office at the FBI, and he keeps Douglas Dillon, an Eisenhower holdover, as his Secretary of Treasury. And Kennedy, I think, came to regret it. Certainly in the case of Dulles, he did. After the disastrous CIA invasion of the Bay of Pigs early in his administration. But at the time, he thought that he needed to do this to reassure the country that he was not going to be, that even though, despite his youth and so on, that he would have older and wiser heads around him.
The argument being that the Bay of Pigs was a kind of intentional failure on the part of the CIA to try and force Kennedy's hand to do more.
That's what I argue. He inherited this mission. It had been hatched, the scheme to invade Cuba with this motley brigade of Cuban exiles. That was hatched during the Eisenhower-Nixon presidency. And, you know, it was given to him as a fait accompli. We have to go ahead with this. Kennedy felt that if he didn't, that it could politically blow up in his face. Alan Dulles told him it was a slam dunk. There was no problem. But I think the scheme all along, and this becomes clear as you really go through the documents, as I did, the scheme all along was to have this motley crew of 1,100 people invade on the beach at the Bay of Pigs. But then they knew, the CIA knew, that they were going to quickly get bogged down unless Kennedy sent in the full power of the U.S. military, airplanes, Marines, and so on. And so what they were doing was trying to trick Kennedy into a full U.S. military invasion of Cuba.
Which arguably ultimately leads to the assassination.
That's what I say in the book. After Dulles is fired by Kennedy, forced out of office, he goes home to Georgetown, but not into retirement. He sets up what I believe was essentially an anti-Kennedy government in exile. He continues to operate as if he's still running the CIA. He's meeting with all his top deputies still at his home, with field agents, including several who are later come under suspicion by the House Select Committee on Assassinations as figures of interest in the Kennedy assassination. So this is not the modus operandi of a man who's going gently into the night. He becomes a critic of the Kennedys. He attacks JFK in speeches as a weak leader who'd rather be loved overseas than respected. This is like Dick Cheney, his criticism of the Obama administration. And even in a more sinister way, he attempts, and his colleagues in the CIA, to subvert Kennedy policy by going around Kennedy's back in places like Italy and trying to countermand basically Kennedy's orders. Alan Dulles, no matter who was president, even when he was fired, continued to think that he and his circle ran the country.
Tufts Law professor Michael Glennon argues that somebody else calls the shots when it comes to running the government. They're members of what he calls the double government. Initially created under the Truman administration, this unelected layer has grown into a hyper-secret and difficult-to-control network with over 46 separate federal departments and agencies and over 2,000 private companies engaged in classified national security operations. Who were the people within the Truman administration at the time who really pushed for these changes, who wanted to see essentially the creation of this double government? Was it people like Alan Dulles and people around him? Where did the impetus for this come from?
It was people like Dean Acheson and the so-called wise men, the Dulles brothers, who were perennial fixtures in Washington. As you know, I noticed that you had the author of the book on the Dulles brothers on your show a few weeks ago. It was these, frankly, members of the Eastern establishment who had a profound distrust of democracy and who believed that if you wanted to have a sensible foreign policy removed from the oscillations of democratic idiosyncrasies, you had to have an elite insulated from the political process that was responsible for foreign policy formulation. These people looked back, for example, at American isolationism prior to World War II. They looked back on the rejection of the Covenant of the League of Nations by the Senate in 1919, and how the democratic institutions they thought had bungled American foreign policy, And the conclusion was that this just has to be done more capably, more efficiently. They established these institutions that would have a institutional memory and be manned by experts. And they are, as a matter of fact.
And they were institutions, and Atchison, the Dulles brothers, and others understood that these institutions could operate arguably outside the control of whoever was president at the time.
You know, it's an interesting thing. The politics were very much reversed in the 1940s during the Truman administration than they are today. That warning was sounded by not liberal Democrats, but by conservative Republicans. The conservative Republican leaders in the Senate and House of Representatives warned that Truman's reforms would lead to what they said, the establishment of an American Gestapo, of a general staff at the head of the armed forces comparable to that of the Wehrmacht that we had just defeated, of a Pentagon that was out of control with the objective of padding its budgets and manpower. They warned of the United States moving to what they called a garrison state. And it was liberal Democrats like Paul Douglas, the senator from Illinois, Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota, who sided with Truman and said, we've got to be on guard of the Soviet Union and recognize that Stalin could strike at any moment. Democracy threatened anywhere in the world as a threat to the United States. So we've got to build up this huge national security apparatus. It was the liberal Democrats who were behind that.
It didn't take long for this apparatus to begin to take on a life of its own. In fact, the Hoover Commission in 1949 talked about the Joint Chiefs being virtually unaccountable.
Oh, that's quite right. And I think Truman recognized exactly what he had created. You know, as Clark Clifford, his aide and former, later to become defense secretary, said, Truman was profoundly distrustful of the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover, but he thought this was the best way of both ensuring the security of the American people and protecting civil liberties. Nonetheless, at the end of his presidency, after Eisenhower was elected, before Eisenhower was sworn in, Truman recognized what had happened. He said, Eisenhower, you know, the great architect of the invasion of Normandy, the supreme Allied commander of Europe, NATO in Europe, Eisenhower is going to be so surprised. He's going to say, do this, do that, and nothing will happen. He'll be so disappointed. That was Truman's experience. And, of course, that's the experience of presidents today. Somebody asked the second president, Bush, what most surprised him about being president, and he said at the end of his term, how little authority I actually have.
John Sopko, the U.S. Inspector General for Afghanistan, tells Who, What, Why that the biggest problem is not theft, but waste in Afghanistan. For example, he tells us of the $500 million spent on airplanes that no one could fly and that ultimately had to be scrapped. Or the gifts of soybeans, which the Afghans will not eat and will not grow. Or about the creation of a navy for Afghanistan, a country that is landlocked. The biggest source of the problem, he tells us, is accountability. But that's changing. Let's take a listen.
The government works a lot different than a Fortune 500 company, as we all know. And that's the unfortunate thing in Afghanistan. The problems we're identifying are really the problems of how the government works. These are the same problems you see highlighted by my colleagues over in the VAIG, dealing with the Veterans Administration, by my colleagues over at the Department of Homeland Security, by my colleagues over at state aid and other agencies, and that you yourself and many fine reporters have highlighted. It's the problem of not having accountability. We don't hold people accountable for losing, wasting taxpayers' money. We have very poor personnel system. We can't hire the right people. We rotate them in and out in Afghanistan too quickly. We reward them for basically spending the money, not for actually accomplishing anything.
Looking at the money spent in Afghanistan, talk a little bit about some of the worst examples from a dollar perspective of the kind of waste that you've uncovered.
Well, from a dollar perspective, I think the biggest waste has been all of the work we have spent on counter-narcotics. We've spent approximately $8 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars on counter-narcotics. And overall, it hasn't really accomplished much of anything.
Have whistleblowers played much of a role in uncovering some of what you've seen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. God bless whistleblowers. And, you know, I have dealt with whistleblowers my entire life. As a prosecutor, as a Hill investigator, as a private attorney, and now as a inspector general. And if we didn't have whistleblowers, the government would be 100 times worse than what it is right now. So God bless them.
We also talked directly to the inimitable Peter Dale Scott about Dick Cheney and the secret post-9/11 world he created. He explains that the true significance of what happened goes far beyond what meets the eye. In this podcast, Scott focuses in particular on the implementation of a secret continuity of government plan that had been decades in the making.
I'll just focus on one of the chief connections, which is the fact that sometime before the last plane hit the ground on 9/11, they implemented something called Continuity of Government Plan, COG. And, you know, in the first analyses of 9/11 right away, not much attention was paid to that. And then when I wrote my book, The Road to 9/11, when I said that these plans, COG plans, had been implemented, two favorable reviews said that I speculated that I did this. No, it says very clearly in the report that the plans were implemented. The trouble is that the phone call which implemented them is missing, but that's probably because it was on a secure COG network. Now, why is COG so important? Because it was being under continuous review by Rumsfeld and Cheney since 1982 in the Reagan administration, at a time when, well, eventually neither of these men were in the government, and yet the plans were very sweeping. They were described in 1987 as plans for the suspension of the U.S. Constitution. And I think in some respects, at least, that was true.
Going back to the morning of 9/11, what do we know about the way this continuity of government plan was immediately put into effect after the first plane hit one of the towers?
There are some important phone calls between the president and the vice president, which are, they asked for records of all the phone calls, and they got complete sets of records, and these phone calls are not in the records. And my explanation for it is that they were using the alternative network that I referred to before, the Doomsday Project, they called it, inside the Pentagon. I think we can time it within a certain period. The last plane went down shortly after 10, maybe 10:03, maybe 10:07, there are different accounts. But there's a 10-minute period between about 9:44 and 9:54. There are many accounts from people like Andrew Card, who are with the president, and who say that, you know, they got a threat there in Sarasota, so as a result, they speeded to the airport, that's true, and then immediately took off. And the report tells us, and I believe it, that that's not true. No, the president waited for 10 minutes on the ground, even though they knew there were Al-Qaeda-type terrorists in Sarasota. And now you go to the vice president, He himself told NBC that he had gone to the bunker, the PEOC, we call it, the President's Executive Operations Center, that he went there before the Pentagon was hit, which would be before 10:34. And the report has him coming into the PEOC at 10:58. Where was he for 24 minutes?
Do you think that too much time has passed to be able to go back and piece together exactly what transpired in this operation on that day?
No, I think the contrary. I think that it took time to begin to discern the outlines of what really happened and to look at the COG part of 9/11 in the context of COG and other events and so on. You know, this is a question that's asked all the time about the Kennedy assassination. And, of course, we've lost now nearly all of the important eyewitnesses to the Kennedy assassination. But at the same time, it's taken years and years, and it's still happening. But we're beginning to get documents declassified that should have been declassified decades ago, which are pointing to... that's my next book. It's going to be out at the end of the month.
We listened as Larry Symes told us about editing a diary of a Gitmo prisoner and reading and learning about unspeakable torture conducted in our name. Why did they go at him so hard? Initially, the FBI questioned him and released him.
Exactly. I think it's a combination of things, it was very interesting at the outset in your intro, you invoked the climate that we live in, we're living in now. I think, it's important to remember the climate after 9/11 and the sort of pervasive fear. And I think a sense of dangerous ignorance about what was going on, with Al-Qaeda and radical Islamic movements. And so, I think there was a kind of round up the usual suspects mentality. And, he had been questioned already because when he moved to Canada, he attended a mosque that was attended by a guy named Ahmad Rassam, who was arrested around the millennium as part of what they called the Millennium Plot. And so everybody who had gone to that mosque in Montreal had been questioned. And so I think we just, we pulled lists and we went at people who we thought could give us some information. And, he had a second cousin who was a close associate of, or a distant cousin, I should say, who was a close associate of bin Laden. And more than that, he had lived in the West. He had lived in Germany. He was, I think he was someone who we felt we could, get information from more easily. And so we targeted him. And we took him to Jordan first, hoping the Jordanians would get information. And every time he was questioned, his interrogators concluded that his story checked out. He was exactly who he said he was. The Jordanians concluded that, and they were ready to send him home. But I think we had a problem. This was now, around the beginning of 2002, middle of 2002, and nobody knew that the United States was sending people to intelligence services, renditioning them to, Jordan and Egypt and these places for interrogation. And I think it would have been, potentially embarrassing at the very least to release him at that point. And so it seems that what happened was that the CIA turned him over to the military, which essentially dumped him in Guantanamo. And when he got to Guantanamo in the fall of 2002, he arrived at just this kind of pivotal moment in the history of U.S. interrogation policy, where, up until that point, the FBI and the Criminal Investigative Services of the military had been trying to control the interrogations there. They had been using non-coercive means of, what they call the floor-building interrogations. But, at this point, the CIA is constructing its black sites, its plans to torture people. Rumsfeld is building a kind of a parallel unit in Guantanamo, which he calls his special projects team. And Mahamudu kind of becomes a pawn in that game. He, you know, I think Rumsfeld thinks that, you know, they can, that his special project team can do what nobody else has done, which is break him and get information from him, which of course he doesn't have. So he becomes one of two, what they call special projects interrogations in Guantanamo. And that, that interrogation, which lasts a year from about mid 2003 to mid 2004, was really one of the most deliberate, stubborn and, you know, brutal assaults on the record. It was this year-long barrage of extreme sleep deprivation, battery, sexual humiliation, a staged kidnapping, death threats, and ultimately a threat to, you know, to harm his mother, to bring her to Guantanamo. That brought him really to the breaking point physically and psychologically.
Once he reached that breaking point, talk about what he was willing to say and what he was willing to agree to at that point.
Well, anything. He has a beautiful phrase. He says, confessions are like the beads of a necklace. When the first bead falls, the rest will follow. He was at this point where he said, look, I'll say anything. I'll tell you what you want. And there's been a good deal written recently about this kind of learned helplessness program that came with these enhanced interrogation program from the CIA, where the objective was really it's based on interrogation methods that were used by the North Koreans during the Korean War against American pilots, and the whole purpose was to get false confessions. It wasn't to get information, but it was to, you know, sort of condition prisoners to, you know, to lose the will to object and then to ultimately feedback stories that you were fed. And so, you know, he's asked finally to confess to an attempt to blow up the CN Tower in Toronto. And as he points out in the book, you know, he's never been to Toronto. He didn't even know that such a tower existed. But it got to the point where, you know, not only was he asked, they would put photographs of acquaintances in front of him and say, tell us a story about this guy. And so he would have to come up with something that person had done. And then ultimately to this, you know, manufactured plot of the CN Tower. And of course, his interrogators knew all this was true. And ultimately, you know, they back off and he's given a polygraph and, apparently cleared. But the objective seems to have been to get him to provide testimonies against anybody and everybody, including people he had never met.
The Bush family came in for its share of scrutiny this year, first from Who What Why's own Russ Baker, who talks about the improbable trajectory and impact of the Bush family, its role in serving the one percenters, and the family's business practices, the military-industrial complex, and war sold under false pretenses.
There were no answers, but in the course of my 5 years of research for Family of Secrets, I eventually began to go down some very, very interesting rabbit holes. And, Peter, that's the nature of investigative reporting, that you've got to be tremendously patient. You cannot force anything, and you cannot assume that you're going to find anything interesting. And for a long time, I didn't find much, except I kept finding things that didn't make any sense. And eventually I began realizing what did make sense. And in a nutshell, George W. Bush became president because another man named George Bush, his father, had been president before him. George H.W. Bush became president because he was vice president. He became vice president sort of paradoxically because he was the opponent of Ronald Reagan, and the reason he was able to even be the opponent of Ronald Reagan was because instead of having been a governor or a senator like most people, he had been the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, there is no former director of the Central Intelligence Agency other than him who became president, so I thought, well, that's an interesting trajectory. I began looking at the father, and I thought, well, why was he even CIA director? And when I went back to the newspaper clippings, I found articles where New York Times, Washington Post were scratching their heads and sort of saying, yeah, I don't get it why this fellow is going to be CIA director. He has no experience in intelligence, no background, no qualifications. And they said, I guess the sense is that he's a likable fellow, and maybe at a time when the CIA is under severe attack and investigation by Congress, since Mr. Bush served very briefly as a member of the House of Representatives, and he is well-liked, perhaps he can defend the interests of the agency. Well, that made no sense at all. So, of course, I began saying there's got to be some other explanation, and, of course, there was. And so the heart of Family of Secrets is how George H.W. Bush actually had a secret life, that he, in fact, was brought in to run the CIA because he was secretly, top secretly, you might say, qualified. He actually had been an asset or an operative of the Central Intelligence Agency for decades before that, undercover as a congressman, a diplomat, an oilman. And so I began looking at that, and I studied the Bush family's history going back into the early parts of the 20th century, and finding them linked up to a whole network of corporate interests, bankers, oil companies and what have you, that were basically gaming the U.S. government for their own benefit, and using their power to protect their assets abroad, their foreign investments, particularly with regard to controlling valuable resources such as oil, gold, timber, what have you. And so I basically began to see why it is that America cannot get past this 1% of a 1% controlling everything, and it's because they really do, in fact, run almost everything in one sense or another, particularly this giant partially covert apparatus that is either can be called the, as Dwight Eisenhower called it, the military-industrial complex, or the new second sort of sister to that, the Homeland Security State.
We also learn from Patricia Goldstone of the life and mysterious death of artist Mark Lombardi, whose drawings walk the line between art and information and reveal the incestuous connections between banking, organized crime, politics, the FBI, the CIA, and the Bush family.
Mark was a conceptual artist, as you said, which means he essentially drew ideas and not water lilies. Some people consider him to be the first great artist of the century, of the 21st century. He's unique in the art world because he used interlocks to create his art. Now, interlocks are basically a form of flowchart tracing overly cozy relationships between boards of directors, and they're common in accounting and in some forms of litigation, but they're very, very unusual in the art world. Mark used interlocks to draw what amounts to a continual visual history of the interconnections between intelligence and organized crime and corporations and governments in the shadow banking industry that we've heard so much about since 2007. He was particularly fascinated in tracing things like money laundering and tax evasion. So he was actually way ahead of Edward Snowden and Julian Assange in releasing a very wide swath of extremely uncomfortable information to the public. What he created was a form of visual WikiLeaks.
Who was it that originally recruited Mark to really start doing this political work in Houston?
Well, I would say it was Farenthold. And, you know, he was already rather motivated personally to do it. According to a note I found in his files, which was apparently written by him, he had a personal run-in with the Bushes. And it was hard to put this story together because nobody really wanted to talk about it, not even Mark. But according to what I pieced together, Mark moved down to Houston straight out of Syracuse University to work as a curator at the Contemporary Art Museum of Houston, which was a very important job for such a young man. He was hired to do that by Jim Harrisis, who was the director of the museum and Mark's college teacher and mentor. And from what I understood from a number of sources, under pressure from the board, Harrisis terminated him after a famous impromptu bread fight at a major art opening, which turned into a major brawl when certain of the eminent guests, who were perhaps inflamed by alcohol and the naughty nature of the proceedings, started ripping apart the installation and throwing it around. and a couple of unidentified artists sailed into the melee and started punching up the guests. Now, Mark never spoke about this incident again, and in fact, his ex-wife told me that if the reason for his firing was introduced into a conversation, he would actually get up and leave the room. But in his personal files, I found this note, which looks like it was written by him, and it reads, "In the late 1970s, which is when this incident occurred, I was working as an organizer of art exhibitions in the Houston area. The First International Bank, which was George H.W. Bush's bank, barged into the scene at about this time, effectively vetoing my participation in a large number of projects." And Mark said in this note, which is an addendum to a piece of journalism that he was attempting, that he embarked on his research as a form of revenge.
Was there anybody specifically, a specific individual that he had had a run-in with from the Bush family that really precipitated this?
No. Again, this is sheer conjecture my part, but from the way the note is put together, it almost sounds as if the Bushes might have been present at this gathering.
What happened to all of Mark's file cards after his death?
Well, all of them is kind of a subjective number, because I was told by one major collector of his work that there were as many as 40,000 file cards. This collector had access to his studio. But what is archived at the Museum of Modern Art in Long Island, their facility in Long Island, numbers about 14,000 cards, a considerably smaller number. And when I went to view the cards, all but four on the financial activities of the Bushes, on whom he focused much of his attention, were missing. That really did strike me as extremely odd. I asked the chief archivist if they had archived the Bush material elsewhere, you know, if I had missed it. And she couldn't answer the question. She referred me to the PR department instead.
Never shying away from controversy, most recently we took on the power of religion as we spoke to David Silverman, the president of the American Atheist Association, who argues to us that religion must die.
We are the ones who call it all bunk, whatever we call it. We are the ones that cast doubt on that which should be doubted but is not doubted. That which should be questioned but demands not to be questioned. So we are the ones who are literally the enemies of those who make money selling the lie of religion, and that goes across all religions. All religious opinion is just opinion, all of it. 100% of religion is cafeteria religion. You only believe in the God you believe in because it's your thoughts, it's your opinions. And that's why people make up their own gods. And until they realize that religion is just opinion, they're going to have this objective morality that's going to prompt them to fight each other and kill each other. And that's why we're going to see ISIL, and that's where we're going to see the Christian right killing abortion doctors.
And yet we have, in the West, we have this patina of religious freedom that we cloak ourselves in, but that doesn't seem to come with the freedom from religion.
And this is where the separation of church and state comes in. You mentioned in your intro, how are we going to get along with all these religions? The only way that that's going to happen ever is with the separation of church and state. And when people understand that the separation of church and state is a synonym for religious freedom, every step away you get from the separation of church and state is a step towards religious tyranny. When one religion gets advantages over another, more advantages, more tyranny. The internet is, that's what's going to kill religion in America. People are losing religion because they finally have access to information. People are losing religion because they finally have access to people outside their religion. And people are losing religion because the tribal nature that people have, you know, the society is becoming an online society. It's not becoming a neighborhood anymore. It's becoming an online society. And this is why religion is dying, and this is why the internet is atheism's best friend.
Is it the goal of atheism and of atheists to be antithetical towards religion, or simply to keep that separation between church and state as strong as possible and allow individuals to live and let live, essentially, and believe whatever it is that they want to believe?
I see theism as a lie, theism as a scam. Religion is a con, and I think it deserves to die. And I don't think it needs to live. And if somebody is religious, I'm not going to get all in their face and try and convert them out of it unless the discussion starts. And if the discussion starts, I'm not going to give religion any sort of buy or any sort of respect, because I have no respect for religion. It's a con. It's a lie. It's a scam. It hurts people. Religion deserves to die. That's my opinion.
This is just a sampling of this year's podcasts, and hopefully you'll come back on a regular basis to listen as well as read whowhatwhy.org.